What is up, everybody? Adrian M. Gibson here. This week, we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to take a break from TBRCon 2023 panels and instead share with you the audio of a live author roundtable on surviving a writing slog. This panel featured authors Crystal Matar, Ed McDonald, MJ Kuhn, and Justin T. Call. And it was so heartening to hear published authors talk about their experiences when confronting the dreaded writing slog, the slump, whatever you want to call it. But hearing their experiences was very valuable, especially to hear how they get out of slumps, but also to know that a lot of authors are on the same page when it comes to this kind of thing. I hope by providing the audio of this roundtable here on the podcast feed will allow all of this incredibly valuable information to get out there into the hands of as many authors as possible. So grab your notebooks, sit back, and enjoy.
I'm going to be hosting this roundtable called Surviving the Writing Slog. My name is Crystal Matar. I am the author of two books, two giant books, Legacy of the Bright Wash, which is a Swiftbook finalist. And this one was my slog, Legacy of Brick and Bone. This is the one that nearly killed me. It's why I thought of this topic. So I thought first I'd go around really quick and let you guys introduce yourselves, and then we can jump in. So MJ, if you want to go first.
Yeah.
Since you're right beside me.
Right? I always wonder if everyone's screens look the same.
Right.
Like all of us, right?
Like, or if we're first, in like a my third order. My...
Yeah, when am I coming up? I don't know. but yeah, so hi, I'm MJ Kuhn. So I am the author. Well, first of all, I'm the regular co-host of the audio show of As If Addicts. So if you guys, you know, come hang out and check us out more. If this is your first introduction to SFF Addicts, we have so much fun over there. But yeah, so I am the author of Among Thieves, which is a fantasy heist story. And the sequel actually comes out in just over a month, July 25th.
That's really exciting.
Comes out. So yeah, I'm super stoked about that. But yeah, so neither of these actually, funnily enough, was much of a slog.
Oh. Lucky.
Many of the ones since then have been a slog.
Oh, so, no.
Oh, I have plenty to talk about there. Don't you worry. But yeah, there you go.
How about you, Ed, if you want to follow up?
So I'm Ed McDonald. I'm the author of the Raven's Mark trilogy, starts with Blackwing. I'm also the author of Daughter of Redwinter, which came out last year, and sequel Traitor of Redwinter is going to be out in October, I think, in both UK and US. And then we've got a third book next year. I'm going to be a really annoying participant in this because I find writing really easy. So
No.
I'm going to be the counterpoint to everyone else.
That's fair. Counterpoints are good. That's part of a good discussion. How about you,
Justin?
Keep it
balanced.
Yeah. One of us can say nice things about writing.
That's what I was going to say. He'll keep us from getting too negative over here.
I am the author of Master of Sorrows, Book 1 of the Silent Gods, as well as Master Artificer, Book 2 of the Silent Gods, and I have a novelette in The King Must Fall by Grimdark Magazine called The Day the Gods Went Silent. So, and I'm working on Master of the Fallen, which is my third book in the Silent God series. So,
is it going to be red like that? That's
it is. It's weird. That's exactly what it looks like. It's blood red with
that's very ominous.
Bronze foil. Ooh. Went from gold to silver to bronze. Last one's going to be bone white with copper foil.
Wow,
very cool.
Really good.
Yes. Cover. And writing, outlining is easy for me. Editing is easy for me. Writing, I'm
Justin,
not like
you it. And me, you yeah. and me, you and me, we're vibing right now. That's how I feel. I'm always like, well, editing's the fun part. The editing first draft is a waking nightmare from the first moment till the end, for the most part. But yeah, editing's
fun. I find that drafting is easy in that I can produce a lot of words quickly. And revising once I know what I want is fun. It's bridging the gap between the two. That's where I get really stuck, where it's like, okay, what do I do with this giant pile of words that I've written? And what am I actually trying to say? Like, this is garbage. Bridging the gap between writing something and knowing what I want it to say is, that's where I really fell down, especially specifically with Brick and Bone. So I guess on that note, we can transition pretty quick, easily into kind of talking about just what your writing routine looks like, just on the surface. Like, are you an everyday type person, or is it, are you squeezing it in around crazy schedules and, you know, whatever it is that got you your books? I'm sure people would like to hear about them. And I'm going to go the reverse way this time and start with Justin. Putting you on the spot.
No, I'm fine. I know exactly what my routine is. It's very easy to explain.
Yeah, good.
So before COVID, it was actually very consistent, because I would take my kids to school, and my youngest I would take to the gym, the rec center, and we'd play for like half hour, and then I'd put him into the daycare and I'd write for like 2 to 4 hours. And usually after like an hour, maybe 45 minutes, I would fall asleep for like half an hour. Because I've got ADHD, my brain likes to shut me down as soon as I try to get writing done. But I discovered if I have my laptop in my lap and I fall asleep for like 20 minutes to an hour and I just embrace it, when I wake up, I can write. I can write solidly for like 3 hours, and it's fantastic. And honestly, like, the editing process is not the Master of Artificer, me and Jillian, we edited that in 6 weeks, and that was like 1,200 pages when I handed it to her. And that was including the back and forth. But writing now, after COVID, during COVID, has been a slog.
Yeah.
So, now I write for about an hour every Saturday at my Shut Up and Write events that I host in Cedar City. And the rest of the time I attempt to write periodically throughout the day, and usually I fall asleep and I don't get it. So.
And the hack isn't working for you anymore?
It should in theory. But maybe I'm just not putting it, you know, I don't have the same structure in place that I used to have. Oh, yeah. So I don't have reasons to go to the gym and sit at the rec center in my chair with my kid in daycare. So I'm just, I can go anywhere and do anything, and it's easy to get distracted. And when I'm not distracted, I fall asleep. So.
That's very relatable, actually.
Yeah.
How about you, Ed, Mr. Easy?
So I don't have any kind of routine. I don't have any kind of structure. As far back as about 2013, I engineered my working life so that I only work 3 days a week, or 2 days a week. And that gives me lots of time. That was choices I made to go into lines of work where I could do that. I write when I feel I should be writing. The thing that makes me really productive is getting away. My favorite times of the year, my partner and I go off to the south of France, and we sit separately at different tables in different places, and we write from 9 till 5, and then we meet up for lunch. We're not monsters, and we have crunchy snacks at 4:15. The rosemary crackers with cheese on and tapenade.
That sounds amazing.
And then,
Ed's secret is having my dream life, is what I'm hearing, right?
Yeah. It's really effective. It's good.
You can't, you know, if you want to write, just go off to France and just
hang out in the south of France.
Yeah,
he's also an author.
The trade off for that is you don't get to have a holiday, because that is the holiday.
Yeah, that becomes your work. Yeah. Yeah,
but that is what I want to do on holiday. I want to just go and be away. I mean, if I'm on a normal day, and I'm bad at getting started, and the way to get started is go right nearly 12 p.m. the pub is going to open, laptop in the bag to the pub. You have as many you can work in the pub until basically it's too embarrassing having to pack everything up into a bag to go to the toilet. So basically you got till your bladder is full.
It's accurate.
But it's three or four drinks. And at that point you've got to go home. So you can do about 3 hours of it and three or four, and then, you know, that's it for the day. But I think part of what makes it easier for me than some other people is I don't believe in editing while I write. I don't believe in going back over anything until you finish the book. And don't worry if it's a pile of crap. And most of it will be. I wrote a bit the other day. I was teaching a lecture, and between two lectures, just managed to do like 30 minutes. And as I wrote it, I thought, this is absolutely awful. Done, ma'am. Still on page.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah, if it's not written, you can't fix it, basically. That's exactly what I learned.
You think it's trash, and then you read it later, and you're like, oh, this isn't that bad, actually.
Yeah. Like, oh, this part's salvageable, and I really like this paragraph. Yeah.
Yeah.
What were you saying, Crystal, about legacy?
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, just getting it done is what turned me into kind of a hobbyist to having a finished novel. because I used to do the thing where, you know, I would be aware of what the book was missing, so I would start over. And so, as you can imagine, I never had any books finished at that rate. it was actually getting on Twitter and listening to other writers talk about how they just have to get the draft done. And then that's what got me something to work with for Brightwash. And then that's when I learned that if I don't pay attention very much, I can write quite a lot of words in a day. Whether or not they're good is besides the point. How about you, MJ? What's your routine or not routine like?
Yeah, so I'm actually like pretty regimented because I still have like a regular job. but fortunately, so like when I was writing Among Thieves and Thick as Thieves, I actually like it was pre-COVID. So I had like a full-time in-office job, 9 to 5, that whole deal. So most of my writing would get done on my lunch breaks and on weekends. So like lunch break, I would, you know, headphones on and tap, tap, tap away for my hour. And then weekends, I would wake up at like 6 a.m. on Saturday and Sunday and write for, you know, 4 to 6 hours before doing whatever else I was doing for the day. Since then, I now work a fully remote job, which is so much easier to work around.
Oh, yeah.
So like, you know, you still have to get in and do the work and do the hours, and you know, that takes brain calories and all that stuff. But I just have a little more flexibility. So I will work on book stuff every morning for 2 or 3 hours before I log into a
job. If you're watching employers, it's before.
No, it literally is, because I have to bill hourly and it's like a whole thing. They can see what I'm doing. but it legit is before I log in. So that's my general schedule these days. But yeah, I'm also a big proponent of sneaking writing time in whenever you can. You know what I mean? Like, I'll bring a notebook with me everywhere I go. Like when I go to the dentist, right? Like I'll get stuck waiting because the doctors and dentists are never on time. I'll be in the waiting room for 20 minutes. Maybe I can scrawl out 200 words or whatever, but that's 200 words I didn't have before. I am a big proponent of drafting by hand. We can talk about that in the slog piece. Because it breaks me out of my slog. I do both. And that's exactly. I go back and forth.
I alternate.
We have the same process, I feel
We're the same person, just different genders and different places and writing different, but we're not the same at all, actually.
I mean, a pen. I don't think I even own a pen.
Oh my god, I have 1,000.
Justin's gonna get us fountain pens up. We're gonna compare fountain pens.
Oh my god.
For writing. I'll be way more than I do.
I love pens, fountain pens.
Let's see if I can hold this up without breaking anything.
Boy, do I have some tips for you guys about productivity. Step one.
I actually found that, okay, so I edit by hand. So I print out what I've written and scribble all over it.
Yep.
And I found that Having the fountain pens and the funny colored ink helped me to conquer my ADHD. If I'm sitting and staring and trying to fix a sentence on the screen, I'm way more likely to get distracted and go off and, you know, let the kids pull me into their drama or whatever. But if I've got a pen and I enjoy using the ink, then it's like it focuses me on something. And if I find I get bored, I change the ink color that I use.
I do that too.
Yeah, and then it's like, yeah. And then
it resets you just a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Just enough to break through that mental block of, okay, I want to use this, so I got to make it worth it. Yeah.
Yeah. Reading it on the printed page, if I'm reading it on the computer screen, I am terrible about just skimming, right? Because I've read it 1,000 times and I'll miss stuff that I need to or want to change. So I have one of two processes there. Either I'll print it out and I'll do the hand editing. I usually do that at least one time for every project. Or I do what I actually just did with my most recent project, where I will just open a blank Word document and I will retype every word of the manuscript.
Oh, wow.
And change. But that's it forces me to read every single word. And then I can change the stuff that's not working. You know what I mean? It's intense. It's not like I'm doing that for every draft, but like a polished
draft, if you're really stuck,
I'm trying to get it ready. Yes.
Yeah.
I'll definitely do that. So, yeah.
And then I find typing it up gives me a second chance to then, like if I've written it down, and I can be aware.
Ed is biting his tongue this whole time. He's like, I don't do any of that.
It's so bad.
I know, but see, that's the thing. That's the beautiful thing, is everyone can have a different process, and all of us have finished books. And I feel like that's the important thing for anyone that's listening, is it's like, none of us have done the same process at all.
Yeah.
And as long as you end up with a finished book, you're doing it right. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
That's my take.
Yeah.
Do you think something that might slow you down is that you're not just writing it on a computer all the time? I feel responsible to have viewers to just suggest, maybe if you just typed it on a computer and then
I get it into my head. And also, Ed, I'm not always at a computer. You know what I mean? Like, sometimes
I found for me, it takes me more editing passes to get all of the little grammar stuff if I'm doing it on the computer, because I'm more likely to skim. But when I print it out on paper, it becomes more of a book, and so I find those the really small things where it's like words like homophones or like just really quirky little things, and
or a little typo or something.
Yeah, or words that sound the same but are different.
I have no idea what any of that stuff is.
I mean, to be fair, I'm closer to Ed on this one than you guys. So
I do know what you mean though. So I convert it onto a popular e-reader format.
Yes.
And then reading it on that, I can see things that I can't see in a Word document.
I do
get it, really. Like,
you're just more eco-friendly than us printing it.
Yeah, my electricity, my triple screening is probably not doing too much good for the environment.
Yeah, we probably even out eventually.
I only use pens for notes, but when I'm drafting, I write in Scrivener for everything, for outlining, for writing, for drafting. But then when I'm done with the first draft, and I don't edit on there at all, I just write. But when I have to edit, I take everything from Scrivener and I move it to Word, and I use my iPad. Oh. I don't even edit after that. I just send it to my editor and I'm like, here you go. I never looked at everything. It's done, because I trust my writing process because it's so slow. And then she sends me the notes and she's like, this is great. And all the stuff she likes is the stuff I haven't edited at all. Like, I only looked at once. That's her favorite stuff. And I'm like, why do I even bother editing? Like, this is pointless. So I stop editing. And then when she sends it to me, then I correct it on my iPad with my pen. But I only use my little electronic pen to edit and add notes when I'm doing the revisions at the very end, right before the book is sent to the copy editor. And that's the only time I do that. Otherwise, I'm just making notes in my journals or I'm writing in Scrivener. That's it.
Dude, and I do 3 drafts before I even send anything to betas. Yeah. So totally different. Well, like, the idea of, like, when I sign with my agent and, like, they wanted to see, like, my first agent, not the one I have now, but my first agent, they wanted to see, like, one of my early drafts. I was, like, horrified. I was like, no. You don't. Exactly. That's the thing, is it's like, it is a steaming pile of nonsense for the first, definitely one draft. Usually at least two. And yeah. Then by draft three, maybe it makes vaguely some sense. Because I'll have, in the first draft, I also don't go back and edit while I'm writing. Because if I do, I will never finish. So as I'm drafting, sometimes I'll get to a point where, you know, God, I killed someone off in act one and I need them. So, well, they're magically alive again. I'll fix it later. You know what I mean? And I do that all the time. So if I were to hand off a first draft, someone would, or I'll change someone's name halfway through, right?
Yeah.
Just make a note of it or whatever. It's all chaos here. But yeah, so if someone were to try to read the first draft of any of my stuff, they would literally not. It doesn't parse. Like, it's not a cohesive story after draft one for me. But yeah.
So
crazy.
On that note, Alicia has asked a question that MJ, you've now kind of accidentally answered. So I'm going to pull it up. do you guys ever have live readers as you write, or does that help or hinder you? So MJ's answer is, God, no. Please, no.
Please don't witness my shame.
How about you, Ed? I know you said you're first drafts are pretty messy, but like, do you find you get people involved pretty early, or does that wait till the end?
So people who know me from social media will know that my partner is Katrina Ward, also an author. When I've finished it, when I've edited it myself, she reads it, gives me some notes, I edit it again, then it's off. I've never had a beta reader other than her. I don't really think it would help me.
I bet it helps though that she's a writer too.
Well, that's what I was gonna say.
If she wasn't a writer, if she wasn't a writer, then I wouldn't even ask her to look at it. If I'm honest.
Yeah.
People's opinions are too different. You see when a book comes out that some people who loved book one don't like book two, and some people who didn't like book one love book two, and some people love both or hate both. Like, so for me, I don't think it would be valuable. Also, I typically have 2 to 3 editors, usually 3 editors working on my books. I get plenty of feedback from those guys.
Justin, I guess you kind of answered it too, that you're ready to send it off, not so much as you write, but after.
Yeah, because I've learned through sad experience, because in addition to ADHD, I have OCD, so I'm like, I am very meticulous about making sure, like, I'll do 12 outlines of a book while I'm writing it, but I don't revise the book. I revise the outlines as I go. And I'm very meticulous about making sure what I write makes sense and is fairly clean. In fact, I've been told by my editor that, like, it's one of the cleaner copies she gets from compared to other authors. I'm like, well, what are other people sending me? Like, I don't understand this is how you write a book, right? Like, it has to look good. Otherwise people think you're a bad author, right? This is the way to do it, right? Am I doing it wrong? What's going on? And then of course Ed like writes really fast. And then he tells me his first draft is not great, and I'm thinking, maybe I'm doing this wrong. Maybe I need to change my
book. You're getting books done, you're doing it right.
But when I do send it off to the editor, I don't have beta readers, but I do have like 5 or 6 people that I trust, that I have good opinions, that are not necessarily authors, but maybe some of them are, but usually they're like friends I grew up with, people at Harvard who are avid fantasy readers, book bloggers. And I will send some of them the first draft at the same time I send to my editor. And so when my editor sends me her notes, I also take all the notes from all my other readers, and I'll take all of those and put that into my revisions. But that's it. Like I send it to the copy editor and we're done. So.
Yeah. Well, that's, I think, having multiple beta readers, because to Ed's point, like, there's no one opinion. Like, I see, when I used to read my own reviews, which I don't anymore because I care about my mental health. but when I used to read them, I would have, you know, some people, like, one comment that was like, God, this, you know, the characters felt flat and da da da. And then the next comment is, oh my gosh, these characters are so vivid, right? So you can't, whatever. But if you get a pool of beta readers, that's why I always have like 3 or 4. And then you kind of take the aggregate of all the stuff. Yeah. Right. So it's like, or sometimes I feel like a beta reader will call out something that shows a different problem, right? Like they may say there's an issue with this scene and I read it and I'm like, I don't think so. It's not hitting right.
But if
right
you backtrack
me, correct. There's an issue four scenes before that. Exactly. So yeah, I feel like there's some trial and error. Like if anyone watching out there has never worked with a beta reader before, you know, obviously I'm sure they're not for everyone, but it's helpful. And yeah, can kind of take all that information. So
yeah, I found a similar thing where it's like people would give feedback, like opposing feedback on the same moment. And you kind of, to me, my point of view is every comment is an opportunity to make it better. So even if I disagree that, okay, this scene isn't working well, I think it is. I think the reason you're upset is exactly what I'm looking for. So yeah. I'll go back and build this up better so it feels more lived in.
Yep.
So yeah, it is helpful to have somebody feeding back so that you can make decisions as you go, depending on where you are in your process. But at the same time, too much, or somebody who like maybe doesn't read the same kind of books that you're writing towards, could really be detrimental. So you want to be careful as you're figuring it out, like who you're reaching out to. Because it's like, if you know, I'm sure Justin, if you sent it to somebody who read mostly cozy fantasy, they would be really unhappy with your books and suggest a whole bunch of changes that make absolutely no sense. But
which I would ignore, because I'd be like, that's not
exactly, that's what not I'm writing. What I,
yeah, that's exactly. Not what you're looking for. Right.
No. I can buy pretty quickly which people have comments that are helpful and which people understand like what your voice is, what you're trying to go for. And when they provide commentary that helps build towards that self-actualized version of your book, you're like, yes, that's exactly right. That's what I need right here. But otherwise, when they're like, you know, I really think maybe you should try that, and you're like, do you know? Are you sure? Have you read my books?
Do you know read what? This genre?
Yeah, like, I'm not writing that. That's a terrible idea. Go away.
But see, I feel like even you learn something from that, right? Because it gives you more sense. You know what I mean? I don't know. I feel like there's value
that would
in
depend,
all
that. That would depend where you are in your journey internally, I think. Because it's like, if you're self-aware enough to know what's happened, then yeah, you can use it. But if you're still kind of like a wee little hatchling baby and you don't have your wings yet, then yeah, that can be really hard to deal with.
Yeah. So.
I like that description of not having wings, because I just like to think of myself as like living in like a bulletproof turtle shell, like those little things in Mario that are like in the caves. You know what I mean?
That's kind of why.
And now you do, but you come right back unless they throw you off the edge of the cliff. But there you go.
Or they have a star or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or they have a star. That's right.
Yeah.
I think it's a really important point to make that. Where you are in, whether you're a hobbyist or whether you're writing for career or anything, it is going to be very different. And
yes,
your individual life circumstances are going to make a big difference. You know, I don't have children. I engineered my day job years ago, so that I have a day job where I work part time. I decided, you know, I took a pay cut back then. I'm very willing to sacrifice that in order to have the free time. I appreciate if you've got three kids to look after and six dogs, you really can't afford to do that. So it's going to change.
Yeah.
So, and also, like, you know, where you are in terms of a publishing schedule. I'm writing my sixth book at the moment. I think before I was published, I wrote 1.5 million words of unpublishable novels, and I did count that up. I did work out how much I've written, and it was 1.5 million. And that, you know, that's what from writing from the age of 15 to 35, I think it was. So yeah, of course it's going to make a big difference to how you approach any of it. And it there is not going to be a one size fits all category. But some things do remain true consistently. I've never used beta readers. I've never submitted my work to an independent editor or anything like that. And I wouldn't. It just wouldn't be something I'd do. But I know for lots of people, they find that really useful and really, you know, helps them with particular issues that they're experiencing. So.
Yep, that makes total sense. So then, kind of back to the slog, when I was posting about this on Instagram, I got some people responding in my stories talking about how they feel guilty about doing things like taking breaks. And that felt kind of tragic relatable. And heartbreaking to me. Yeah, relatable, but also no. No, please don't. So I'm wondering if you can think of maybe some kind of, I don't know, times when you have taken breaks, and also why it's important. And I'm going to start with you, Ed. Have you ever taken a break from writing?
Yeah, I take breaks all the time. I regularly just take a month off. If I have something else I have to be doing, I have to be doing that instead. I think it's important. There's lines of advice you'll find on the internet which will say, write every day, build the habit. And it's true, it does help and it does work. That doesn't mean you have to write every day. It's in your writing periods. If you are writing every day, it gets easier each day to re-engage with the writing. And I get this, and so I go on runs. I think of it as like being on a run. Like, today I wrote 2,500 words, tomorrow I'll probably do more, the day after, and I'll build up speed, and then one day I'll just go, man, I'm knackered, I'm taking the weekend off. and I might not pick it up again for another week. And I think if it's just become something that is actually a daily grind to you, you're not going to produce anything good. Like, get outside, go and look at something green, like climb a steep hill, like see some water, like talk to people you wouldn't normally meet.
Small village.
I find small villages largely a waste of time. I would go for medium-sized villages enough.
They take too much time away from your writing.
Depends if you use a computer or try and kill them all with a pen.
The pen is mightier than the sword, but the computer is I don't know.
You just press the button.
There's a punchline in there somewhere.
That's not nearly as satisfying.
So I take breaks all the time, and I took a fairly big break the end of 2021, I guess it would have been. I was ill for a while, but then sort of got back on it. I don't think I was any more productive in lockdown, where I was working from home, than I've been outside of lockdown. And I know for some people, the more they work, the more they write. I remember reading a foreword by Glenn Cook where he said, like, after he retired, if anything, his writing output reduced. And, you know, it's that thing of, if you want something done, give it to a busy person. I say write when you want to write. And if you have the luxury of choice, if you literally have to squeeze it in every day, you're going to squeeze it in. But I think it's more important to see new things and have new experiences than it is to commit to routine.
Yeah, even if that's reading a lot of really great books that inspire you, if you can't get anywhere for whatever reason.
Well, there's always somewhere, you know? If you're deep in the countryside, walk down a different road. If you're in a city, go to that night that you would never normally go to with people you've never met before. If you genuinely you have mobility issues or something like that, then but find a Zoom group and talk to people that you know. I think if we rely too much on other people's media, I think perhaps we don't get enough real experience, and to me, writing is all about having emotional experience and sending it to people.
Yeah. How about you, MJ? You said that the books that you're working on lately are more of the slog. Did you have to take a break, or are you still fighting through them?
Okay, so I am like the poster child of what not to do. So like, don't listen to me. Yeah. I don't take breaks. I don't.
My inspiration take breaks. Story is gonna be the same.
That's not like I take breaks from a project is the thing. So right now I have 4 works in progress going on. And they're all at different stages, right? So some of them are in editing, one is in drafting, one is in outlining. And when I get burnt out on one, I switch. This is an advantage that I have right now because I'm not under contract, right? So I'm not on deadline for anything. So, and since I'm also not under contract, like just like a little peek behind the publishing world curtain, I'm also not trying not to put all my eggs in one basket. So I have 2 complete, like ready to submit projects right now. Right. So you don't want to, you know, if publishing isn't feeling story A, I want to have story B, story C, story D ready to go.
All lined up.
Because I'm committed to making this publishing career work. And there's so little you have under your own control when you're in the trad hub side of things. And I want to go hybrid. So I want to work. I want to indie pub my first indie pub project as well. So we need to have multiple irons in the fire at all times. It's definitely not something that I would recommend to everyone. I think breaks are important. And I take breaks like on the small scale. Like if I get stuck, I'll go for a run. Or you know what I mean? I still like go do stuff and see people. But just like in terms of like, do I put my like hours, word count, page count, whatever it is I'm doing every week? Yes. So don't do what I do because it's probably really unhealthy. That's it.
Well, on that note, actually, Alicia again is saying that we're offering this advice, but at the same time, we all have active stuff, which, yeah, guilty. how about you, Justin? Dad there.
If what MJ is doing is unhealthy, I'm the other opposite of the spectrum there because. I think that when I think I tried to write every day at a certain point. Once COVID hit, things kind of went out the window because it was like my kids were in the house all the time and I was taking care of them and helping them with schoolwork and remodeling a house. Then I went through a divorce and finding a new job and moving to a new city and moving twice. It was like forest fires, all these crazy things were going on. And it was like, I do not have the bandwidth to write words about this thing that I love, that I know really well, that I've been working on for 15, 20 years. So I would, even when I would sit down to write, I would find it impossible to do so. I just had too much that was filling up the brain space. I have less going on. I'm teaching just like one class here at the university and for the summer. I'm teaching at 5 in the fall. But I try to keep a little bit more of a part-time schedule, kind of like Ed, so that I can have a little more flexibility. I try to keep more balance in terms of seeing friends and family and not being a recluse who does nothing. But when I am writing, I tend to have writing goals and words are extremely important. Like when you have a word count goal and you're like, I am going to write this many words today. And I did. And you aren't allowed to go back and edit yourself. You aren't allowed. Even the words are like, I hate everything I just wrote. I will like go through it and I'll do a strike through, but I'll leave the words there because they still count. Cause I know I wrote them and they're still there. And then later on, I'll go and take those out. But I still, because I'm OCD, I'm like, well, I got to put that strike through so I remember that was garbage and I'm going to fix it later. but I'll get my words in or get 2/3 of the words that I was planning. It doesn't matter. Like, goals are there so that you commit to something and you deliver something. Yeah. If you don't have goals, you're like, if I feel like writing today, well, you won't. I know that because I've been doing that for the last 2 years. I have to be in this place and I have to stick to this routine either because somebody else is counting on me or because I've made a commitment to myself and I'm going to do it, then you will. You might not meet your goal. And if you're me, almost definitely won't because you always set goals that are higher than you should. And then you feel disappointed and feel bad, but you still get the words done and eventually through accretion, it gets done. So take breaks because and don't feel bad about don't feel bad about your word count. I know a lot of authors are like, I wrote 3,000 words today, or I wrote 2,500 today. And I'm like, that's great. That's wonderful. It's you, maybe you're Ed. I don't know. But I'm like, if I got 1,500 in, I'm like, that was a good day for me. I am doing well. And that was before COVID. And now I'm like, hey, I got 500 words in today. I feel great. That's fantastic. Today I wrote 700 words in 40 minutes, and I was like,
well, that's really
why can't I do this every day? Why don't I do, what is going on here? Something is different.
It's a sign that it's starting to come back a bit for you.
There yeah. You yeah. That's what I'm hoping. I feel like I'm at that cusp right now in terms of like, I'm coming out of a slog. So
that's good. Ed, you were gonna add something.
I was just wondering, just to sort of answer that, I was just wondering what you would set yourself as a daily target if you're on a day where you had no other responsibilities, what would you aim for? Yeah, and say 1,500 maybe. Is that right?
For me?
Yeah.
In theory, yeah, and then I'd get probably 500. But once I get up to 1,500, then I'd move my goal and I'd say, okay, now I'm going to go through for 3,000 or 2,500. Something.
I do that too.
Yeah. So I'm never satisfied with the minimum. If I hit 500, for example, I'm not going to knock off and be like, great, I'm done. If I hit 500, I'm like, great. So I'm writing. I'm going to keep going. I'm going to do more. In fact, one of the reasons I like my Shut Up and Write events is because I have to be at a certain place at a certain time to write. And other people are going to be there. They're expecting me to host the event. So I'm going to be there. I'm planning on it. I'm going to write. I have 1 hour. I'm going to do it. And then when the event's done, it's like, well, I'm at a coffee house and I've been writing and I'm in the groove. So why not keep writing? Except that kind of backfired because like one of my students started coming and they have to walk to the event and they're like 20 minutes away. Like walking. So I start giving them rides and then I stop writing and I'm like, what am I doing? I'm sabotaging myself. So, but yeah, 1,500 is probably what I would go for as a goal in theory, if I didn't have anything else going for the day. Why? What about you, Ed?
How about everyone else?
Yeah.
Well, my word count goals have changed. Like when I was younger and more hopeful in life, I would aim for 2,000-3,000 words in a day, whatever. And then, you know, my day job got more intense, right? It was like I have been moving into different roles that require more brain power to do, and you know what I mean. You have less mental calories left over to write. And, you know, then COVID happened. Oh my God. Right. And then everything fell apart for everybody. So I feel like I agree with Justin. I'll aim these days. It's more like 1,200-1,500. But there was a period in like deep COVID times, like in 2020, where I was like 250 words. That's all. That's it. Like, just please, for the love of God, write something. You know what I mean? Because it was hard to get myself to. And then I would end up writing, you know, 400. And I would feel good about that, though, because I had aimed for 250 and I wrote 400. Whereas if I was still aiming for 1,500, I think I would have burnt myself out because I would have kept banging my head against that wall trying to hit that goal. And I just didn't have the capacity for it at the time. So.
Ed, your smile tells me you probably write a lot more than that.
That is actually a good one. That is because I was watching MJ's cat just having a nice stretch at the top of the bookshelf.
I know. Yeah, he's been lurking back there this whole time. He's up there. He's been napping up there.
He looks like a statue.
Yeah.
A little gargoyle.
I would, for a day where I have no other responsibilities and nothing else to do, I normally aim for two-hour writing periods. It's not that I set them as time, it's just that's normally how long I write for before I feel I'm at a point where I'm taking a stop. I think of myself as having about 4 hours of creativity in me a day, and in that time I can 3,500 is acceptable, 5,000 is a good but I probably delete 50% of everything I write as well. So I write long and then just scrub it out because I don't know why I'd have my best ideas planning anything. I don't believe in planning. I think it's an error.
Now you're hurting.
I tried your method and it completely sabotaged me. So I am definitely on the opposite side of that.
I have also tried the pantsing thing, and
You're not gonna have your best ideas while you're planning out a book, like chapter by chapter.
Well, yeah, that's why you plan it, and then you have flexibility. You're ready to abandon plan if it's not working.
But you can plan a whole book, and then during chapter one, you're like, well, this side character's interesting. Maybe they should be the protagonist. Yes. New book! And then all the planning's done.
But you can do that and go back to the outline.
Right, 15 outlines.
I'm kind of in between you guys where I plan, like, what I'm on. So, you know, I find my best writing time is first thing in the morning. So I wake up and I have like 20 minutes or so while I'm making coffee, and I'm thinking about, okay, today I have to accomplish this scene and I want this to be addressed and I need this much action, and then I can go. And I can go, like, I can get many thousands of words like that. And I have to know, like, the end goal for the story. Like, I have to know what I'm going towards, but otherwise everything is a big nebulous chaos zone. And I find I have to have that time to think about what I'm going to do either the day before or the morning of, or else I sit at the keyboard and go, for an hour or two, and then I get discouraged and walk away, and that's it for me for the day. That being said, when I started deciding that I wanted to get back into writing, my goal was one sentence a day, just because I was so exhausted. I had pretty young children, but I needed to get back to writing. So, you know, sat down one sentence a day, and if I got that, great. I often didn't get that because it would just be me reading what I had done over the last little while. And it builds, like you said, and that momentum built to a point where when I was doing the last pass on Brick and Bone, I was easily doing 7,000 words a day, and up to 10. Now, however, I'm really burnt out now. So that's my hyper-focus kicking in, and I, you know, forget to have meals and stuff, which is probably also not healthy. But the other side of that is now I have to start a new project eventually, and I'm just really tired, and I feel like I'm back to, okay, if I can start doing one sentence a day, I'm gonna do really well.
But eventually. See, that's the thing, it worked for you last time, like, why not
worked,
try that again?
It worked. I got the book out on deadline. I squeaked past the Amazon. I guess I'm the only self-published author here. So for those of you that don't know, if you put a pre-order up on Amazon, they will lock you out of the file 3 days before your launch day because they don't want you in there messing with it 3 days before, because that's like the maximum amount of time they need to upload it to the system. So Brick and Bone released the 25th of April. And so I was locked out on the 22nd, and I uploaded the final draft proofread on the 21st.
There you go.
That's why I had to do 10,000 words a day. I had no choice because I set too hard of a deadline for myself. Now Justin's shaking his head at me. I've broken both Ed and Justin today.
I think it's good. I always write the last 30,000 words of a book in 4 days.
I desperately need a deadline.
Always.
Yeah. Because if I have no deadline, it's...
But that's just the end, because once you get to the end of the book...
The end.
It's just... Yeah.
It's a sprint.
Reveal, it's betrayal, reveal. Everyone dies. Hero walks out. Poignant moment. Melancholy. Done. Book.
Everyone dies. Riots in the streets. Yeah.
The last third of a book is...
Dominoes is the hard part at the beginning, but then once you have the momentum to knock them down, that's my sweet spot. I love that feeling.
Yes, that's why I spend so long writing the first third of a book, and then a normal amount for the second third, and then the last third is like...
Yeah. It's
just an avalanche.
Beginnings are easy, middles are hard. That's what I find.
I was going to say, for the first, like, 10-15,000 words of a new book, I'm always like, oh my god, I'm a genius, this is the best thing I ever wrote, like, it feels great. And then I get to the middle where I have to actually start
paying
you know
off.
What I mean, I'm not just setting stuff up now, I have to like actually start to knit a little more, and I'm like, oh god, I broke everything, it's terrible now, you know.
So, So when I get to that point where everybody else is like, oh no, I'm like, my reaction is like, I think I've outlined too much. I'm not going to be able to fit it all in.
Oh, yeah.
I need to change the outline again, because otherwise I'm not going to finish the book where it needs to end.
Yeah.
I have a problem. This is a problem.
That's my problem. With like a real chonker that's like, you know, 1,200 pages or something.
We do.
That's what I turned in for my last book.
Yeah. There you go.
Rewrite hefty babies, and we both have to I thought I was gonna get a few more plot points into Brick and Bone than I did, but I was like, I don't think Amazon will print this book if I keep going. I'm gonna have to stop. So I had to like reverse engineer a satisfying ending. So yeah, that's
yeah, I got 90,000 words into one book and then realized I didn't have an antagonist. The characters are just wandering around having a lovely soap opera with each other. And I was like, I'm sure something's meant to happen in this book.
That is the hazard of pantsing, though.
Yeah. I can't even imagine what that's like. That's like having that disorder where you can't make images in your head. That like. Aphantasia. Christopher Rocchio has that. Yeah. Like, I don't even know what that's like. I can't imagine that.
Yeah, well, I would say the one time I tried pantsing, I had like that same situation where I got like 60,000 words in and was like, this is going absolutely, I have no idea where this is going, right? Like, I don't know. But like, you know what I mean? It's to your point about getting great ideas when you are just kind of letting it flow. That's where I came up with the world that ended up being the world in Among Thieves. So, you know what I mean? It's like, I was able to cannibalize it for parts. So it was fine.
Yeah.
I'm usually like a really intense outliner. And then like one of the ways that I combat the slog is every time, because you know, the middle is a slog for me with pretty much every project. When I'm writing, I will, you know, I never stop writing for the day at the end of a scene or the end of a chapter, ever. I will always start the next so that the ball is rolling when I sit down tomorrow. I didn't know that was a thing that he did, but yes, perfect. I'm just like Hemingway, guys.
Yeah.
then the other thing that I'll do if I'm really like struggling is, I have a cat on my lap now, is I will write 3 or 4 bullet points of what I'm going to write tomorrow before I actually stand up. So I'll be like, okay, this is where I ended today. Tomorrow, remember, you got to write this conversation, this, you know, argument, this whatever, blah, 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 blah. It just helps me because then when I sit down, I'm not staring at a blinker. You know what I mean? Yep. I am like,
yep,
I have, exactly. This is my like assignment for the day. Thanks, past MJ. Like, so yeah, that's what I'll do there.
Yeah, that's so far. That's been the extent of my planning. That sort of thing.
I'll have three goals for every chapter, and I'll have all the chapters outlined for my book and the next 10 books. And then I'll just not write anything after that. So.
But when you do, you're ready.
It's all there. I can stop at any point. I know it's connect the dots at this point. I know everything. And then if I go off rails, it's like, oh, that's easy. I'll just make another outline and then add another 12 outlines and it's fine.
Add more outlines.
Yeah.
Right. Well, that's, I feel bullets. Like with my multiple works in progress at the same time, the only reason why I feel secure switching gears like that is because I do outline. Because if I didn't, I wouldn't have, you know what I mean? You'd lose the thread of the story you were telling. And then once you jumped back into it, it would be like, oh God, I have to like reacclimate myself. So we think that that does give some power too, where it's like, okay, this is the general trajectory of where the story's going. Now I can set it down for 6 months and work on something else. And when I pick it back up, I can be like, oh yeah. I know what I was going to do here. Yeah, thanks. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So that makes sense with your juggling. That makes a lot of sense with your juggling. Cause then, like you said, if you have to set it down,
you'd forget, you'd have to reread everything you'd written so far, and it'd take forever.
I've experienced that recently because I printed out something that I had started working on I don't remember how long ago it can't have been that long ago, but it feels like it. And you know, there's little lead lines in there where so and so doesn't know what I've done, and I left a question on the printout: what have you done? Because I can't remember what it was trying to set up, so I probably have totally rewritten this person's backstory without even knowing it, because apparently I forgot a bunch of stuff. So yeah, that's relatable.
Oh, I love that. Second take was probably better anyways than what you
had. Yeah, it'll be better now.
It was more refined. Really, you're bad. Good.
Yeah. And I think another thing to talk about for the slog, it's not only the act of writing. Hopefully writing becomes a book and a book becomes published, and then you unlock a new level of slogging. Achievement unlocked, now you have to market. And yay! I'm wondering if any of you, I know for me, my relationship with writing changed very deeply after publishing Brightwash, and it happened kind of in the background. I didn't notice it happening until recently, that, you know, before Brightwash, it was, I'm going to write this and I'm going to publish it one day. And so I felt a little bit braver about things that I was going to do because nobody had to see it. And then transitioning into Brick and Bone, it's like, okay, I got to get this right because I've made some promises. This is going to be published soon and I better get it out. It actually made it harder to work on the book because I was kind of like, for me, the slog came less the writing and more from the fear and, you know, a little bit of
paralysis. You have a readership now. You don't want to disappoint them. You want to pay off what they want. Yeah, I totally get that.
I'm wondering if you guys felt the same way. And Ed, you've got the most books out, so I'm wondering if that's something that's way in the past for you, if ever, or if it's something that you go through each time or anything like that.
Not really. I don't really worry about it, to be honest. I write the books
because he's writing in the south of France. He's so chill.
I just write the books that I like and that I.
Yeah.
You know what? You know how like commonly given bit of advice is write the book you want to read.
Yes.
Well, I do, and I've written the books I like reading the most.
We have to read them the most. So
yeah, so I just write them, and then I'm happy with them. I think in terms of,
and
like,
you're so
feeling beholden,
I'm jealous.
I know. Let's all strive to have Ed's health strategy.
It comes from having the personality disorder of gross, overly active ego. I don't have the thing that a lot of authors have where they're like, I'm so plagued with self-doubt. I'm like, no, my books are really good. Like, I really believe in them. If I didn't think they were, I wouldn't let them be published.
I mean, I have the same problem as you, Ed, but I'm not writing as much as you, so I don't understand what I don't think it's like.
Well, what you need to do, Justin, is arrange for regular trips to the south of France, and then all of your problems.
Yeah.
I don't think that'll change anything.
give up all the other things in life so that you can just do that.
I have. I've done that too.
Yeah.
But I don't feel beholden to an audience. I mean that you are in terms of narrative often, like, so but only in terms of what you've done deliberately and what you set up. So, you know, you find that for those who've read Raven's Mark trilogy, a major character dies at the end of the second book. And I thought, I have killed off the fan favorite character. I know I've done that. How can I include that character in book three throughout the whole book? Because I think if I don't put them back in, people go riot. but it was also just I didn't resurrect them or anything. I just found a way of not omitting them from the series. So I guess, but I think as much as possible, you've got to isolate yourself from that. And I think the most valuable skill you can have as an author is to simply not give a shit. Like, if you care what your readership think, then you are writing for, it's almost like you're becoming ChatGPT and you're writing for an amalgamation of what other people want rather than just making the book. Like, would it be better if let's think, what's a book that's never widely criticize anyone else's books in the stream. There are books where people have disliked the way the endings were dealt with, you know? I don't think those authors should feel that they've done the wrong thing. I think it's all right for the audience not to like them, because there is no objective quality. There is no mark of good literature. Some of the books that are the most popular are, let's be honest, terribly written in terms of prose. They're cliched, they're derivative. They're embarrassing, quite frankly, to read. And some of the books that find no readership at all are astonishing, brilliant works of genius. Except not everyone feel the same way about that. And given that, there's no objective measure of quality, which means the only thing you can aim for in writing, you can aim to make money, and you can aim to be proud of what you've done. And the second one has to come first. You've got to be proud.
Oh, yeah.
And hopefully, hopefully the zeitgeist and fortune and everything else just conspires to make you some money along the way. And you can't control it.
Right. Well, that's, I think it is so important, like with what you said, where, you know, you can't please everyone. And I think that's the scary thing, but also the beautiful thing about taking a book and putting it out into the world, because it's no longer, it's gone from something that is just wholly and fully owned by you. And, you know, because I wrote the books I wanted to read, you know what I mean? That's what I always do as well. And now it belongs to the audience too. And they're going to have feelings about it. They're going to have thoughts about it. Like, but that's the thing. Here's the thing. I can't control how they receive it. And that's why I don't read my own reviews. Mm-hmm. I can't control how the audience receives it. I can't control what they think of it, how they interpret certain things, how they feel about it. So I'm making the same point as you, Ed, where it's like, I'm not going to write because, you know, oh, I think that people expect this to happen. I mean, I outlined the entire duology of my books before book one came out. I already knew how it was ending before anyone read book one. So you know what I mean? Am I worried? Do I really hope that my readers enjoy it and that I hope that they, you know, find joy in it? Of course I do. But if I was writing to try to please everyone, you can't.
Yeah.
And you're gonna just get I know writers that they just get that mired in reading their own reviews and it drags them down so hard. And it's don't do that. Don't do that. Be kind to yourself, because you can't control how people perceive
read
it. You can't.
All the reviews for book one for the first 2 years it was out. Every review on Goodreads, Amazon.
No.
Same thing with Master Artificer. Well, I wanted it to toughen myself up, but I also really wanted to understand, what do people think I'm writing? Because I know what I'm trying to write, but am I achieving what I think I'm achieving? And I wanted to like to know, like am I making because I have 10 books, 12 books outlined in my head. I know where I want to go. I'm planning to get there, but do people think I'm getting there, or do they think I'm going in a different direction? So I wanted some feedback. I wanted to know. And I got that feedback. It was like, okay, so I had no idea I wrote dark epic fantasy until I published book one. People were like, oh, this is dark epic fantasy, and then people were like, oh, it's grimdark. It's like I don't know what I'm just.
You start seeing the tags on your Amazon page, and you're like, oh, interesting. I didn't know
that's what I write. Okay, that's helpful.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah,
I had more or less the same experience where I mean, I knew what I was writing in that, you know, what genres I was mixing. But then, you know, reviews and as well as Spiffbo, made me highly aware of what I may or may not have succeeded at. And people talked about how dark it was. I'm like, really, is it that dark? Okay, I guess so.
I'll just wait to see where I can go.
You're like, this isn't dark. This is just...
It's not that dark.
Like, this is book one. Wait till we get
to
book
five. Yeah.
And I found in some ways being aware of how people... It's less pleasing and more being aware of how people perceived the series. And I wanted to consistently hit those expectations and hopefully surpass them.
Yep.
And that's where I got in my own way, because people mentioned two things with Bright Watch. It's either the romance or the darkness, and or both. And so then, like, how do you market something like that? And that's
dark romance.
I'm calling it grimdark romance or romantic grimdark. Actually, you have to be careful not to call it capital R romance, because the certain happily ever after is kind of
Gotcha. Yeah. So well, then, that's true, because then the audience expectations, they're automatically going to one-star you. You know what I mean? And that's
exactly.
Not because of how you wrote it. It's because of how your
market
is, the whole thing.
I found once I could divorce the perception of my success from those reviews and angle more towards this is a tool for me to market with, everything fell away and it just got so much easier just to finish. But yeah, that transition period was my slog. I guess, hang on. Evan's giving you kudos. And it's true. It helps that divorcing of self-perceived quality. If you're writing something that you care about, then at least you can stand behind that as a decision, whether or not people agree with you. It's like, I get where they're coming from, but I made this decision on purpose, and that helps.
If you're doing it for any other reason than because you want to be proud of what you've created, I think you should do something else, because this is not a reliable income. This is not a good income for most people. It's the main thing that generates success in literature, first of all, there is a base level of talent that you have to be displaying, but at the same time, you hit the right moment with the right book, and it requires you to get lucky in order to have that.
Yes.
You know, go and do an economics degree, go and work in the city, like work, go and be a stockbroker for 10 years, make all your money there, and then quit. And then live off what you've made and write books for fun. Like, that's a better plan.
Yeah. And there's also more marketable or more market definitions of success in some of those other. Because if you're doing it for success, I don't know, man. Like, it's so hard to measure.
What does it even mean?
Moving goalposts, man.
Successful? Yeah.
Yeah.
And to that point, I think if part of your slog is because you've overshot what success looks like for you, I think an important thing is to kind of take some time to think about what's achievable and what your priorities are, and if you scale back your priorities to something you can actually control, like writing a book that you're proud of, it helps to cut away all of that artificial or unattainable things. Like, we can't control, you know, we can only write the book that we have with the skills that we have and the interest that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And after that, it's out of our hands. So, and then, as Alicia is also saying, that, you know, art, it just is. Like, there's no way to measure it. It's only, its existence is enough, I think.
But as a reader, she wants her favorites protected, which I understand. Yeah. I'll get mad if one of my favorites dies, but then also I like that, because then I'm like, this must be done well if I'm attached enough to this character to be mad that they died. You know what I mean? So it's like, for me as a reader, I'm like, I'm so mad. Also, good job.
my favorite, I guess it's not on my shelf, David Gemmell. After I read a certain number of David Gemmell books, I noticed the pattern that he always kills my favorite character in every single book. And I mean, I have all of them. I devoured them. I reread them. In Stormrider, when I'm ready to cry, I'll reread that book, and I find I start tearing up like about, you know, 20 pages, 30 pages before the actual event happens, because
you know it's coming.
They're setting up the big plan, and it's like, this is it. and that it ends me, but it's, you know, it's memorable. So Actually, Alicia threatened me because at the end of Brick and Bone, she said, if everybody dies, you're getting a one-star review or something like that. So,
you're like, I guess you'll have to read and see.
I guess so, yeah. Yeah.
I enjoy murdering fan favorites, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
But that's the thing, because that's going to get the emotional reaction that's the strongest. So, like,
but I don't do it arbitrarily, but, like, if this is what needs to happen, I'm going to do it. And I'm going to enjoy it.
Redacted dies in my sequel. So, yeah, someone dies, be ready. I didn't want it to happen as the writer, even. I was like, no. But it had to, right? So it's like, it's not like I just did it for the cheap thing. It was like, there's no other way this can go.
This
like,
must
it
occur.
It would read cheap if it went differently. Yeah. You know, to me. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If that part, I find we have to be cognizant of what we're promising and if we pull it the wrong direction. Now, there's a difference between a twist and like kind of an artificial twist.
Yeah.
But definitely there's a couple of characters that I don't know, I don't know if I can do it, but anybody else is fair game. And somebody said with my books, there's a couple of characters where they wonder, oh wow, how is this character going to get out of this situation? But then everyone else is, oh my god, this person might die. Which is a nice feeling.
I like to not trust myself. I like to go and being like, you know, I'm planning to write this, but like, I could get to the end of the scene and be like, oh, that character has to die now. Oh, I was not expecting that. Okay, I guess they're dead now. So what? Now I got to make it work. And that's fun. Or you're planning to kill someone, and you're like, oh, they survived. I was not expecting.
Right?
What am I going to do
now? How'd they get out of that one? Look at them go. Yeah.
Well done.
Scrappy
nice job.
Character.
You thwarted me.
I have one character where he was supposed to just be backstory, and he was allegedly supposed to have been dead. And filling him out as a character, I'm like, god damn it, he's so interesting. So you kind of rescue them. He's not dead. Everybody just thinks he's dead.
Right? He faked his own death or something.
Exactly. I guess that's about all I had planned for us. If there's any questions about the slog specifically, you can definitely jump them in or put them in and I can put them up.
Drop
but,
them in the comments.
I really appreciate everyone coming by. And this is important. You can tell the difference between some readers, where some readers are like, this book destroyed me, I cried for days, I'll never recover. You have to read it. It was the best.
Yep.
And PL dropped by, so hi PL, thank you very much.
Hello.
Evan again. Thank you. That's exactly the feeling.
That is what it is though, right? Where it's like, oh, I felt something. It's not a positive thing, so I'm mad initially, but effective.
It's memorable.
It makes the story better than it's the right decision.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a little bit of Alicia has asked for
The new ink.
Yeah.
Bring it in.
So there's it's a raven skull with some poppies, and then the one that I didn't have a picture of is books.
Oh my god, I love it.
Books.
Those are beautiful. So,
if only because it felt topical, this is how much I love books.
Yes, right?
Oh,
I have no tattoos, so I have nothing to show off.
It has a lot. I can see every time you lift your arms, you've got.
Yeah. Of a, this is actually the Raven's Mark trilogy as a tattoo.
There you go.
I love characters and various other things.
That's fantastic. I got a henna tattoo of my magic system like 2 weeks ago or something. So
well, now you're testing it out, right? So you're gonna commit soon.
Yeah, we'll see. But I really like my magic system. I've got it up there, so you know.
Oh, that's nice. Gorgeous. Now, did you do that? Because I know you did the map, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I design everything, and then I'm like, all right, I am not an artist, so I'm going to find somebody to make it look pretty.
We're going to peer pressure you now.
Into getting a tattoo. Yeah. Join us.
Just it's a beautiful two of my two magic systems right there. Maybe.
There you go.
Feel cool. Join the club.
Yeah, we're not going to rest until you've got a tiny little bit of ink somewhere. And then once you start,
just
you'll...
like a little one, like just on your wrist.
There are two types of people, or three types of people. People have no tattoos. People have one and thought that was plenty. And then there's full sleeve people.
Yeah, well, I'm working on my sleeve. I got I got one. But that was the thing. It was like the first tattoo that I got. I was like, it took me like 4 years to get it. And I was like questioning myself every time and like, I don't know if I should do it. And then like since then, I'm like, ooh, I just booked a new tattoo appointment. Like,
yeah,
I'm going to get this thing, right? Because it's just, that tats are the way.
See, I had this all done over, five sessions of 5 hours. And it was all one design. And that's it. That's just the one.
Yeah. And that's it. You're satisfied now? So that's pretty special though for your own series. Yeah.
Well, if you're going to get inked, get something you think you'll never regret.
Yeah, and that's
100%.
That's a good one to keep. That's a
I started the opposite way of MJ, where my first couple, I was like 17, 18. I had cash in my pocket and freedom. And I was going to go get inked. And now I hate those tattoos. And in fact, these two have covered the really embarrassing ones.
Always a solution.
I got them both done on the same day just because it's like, I have to get rid of these. I hate them so much. And now I have more books, so it's worth it.
I love it.
Okay, well, I guess that's about all for the slog and a extra tattoo session.
Tattoo tour.
Exactly. So what I'll do is we'll round up and everybody can say where folks can find them. I know all of you are on Twitter, but otherwise, and I'm going to go the reverse of the introduction. So Justin, where can we find you and what can we expect from you?
Let's see. I guess where all good books are sold. So it's on Audible, it's on Kindle, it's on Amazon, but it's also in bookstores.
Gorgeous hardcovers.
If you can find the gold foil editions, those are still the best ones, but those are like the first editions and maybe second. And so now it's hard to find those, but yeah. If you're in the UK, Waterstones usually stocks it. And if you're in the US, Barnes & Noble probably doesn't stock it because I'm not as prolific here in the US as I am elsewhere, but ask them to order it and then they'll get it for you. So
it's true. Ask for it at your library, ask for it at the bookstore, ask for it anywhere, and then suddenly they'll be all over your town and you'll be a hero.
You got it.
Do you have a website or just Twitter or?
I need to update my website. It's like frozen right now. I'm on Twitter. I'm active on Twitter. I will respond on Twitter. I'm on kind of on Instagram, but Justin_T_call. So that's just, you saw, Colin Hodges saw it at Barnes & Noble a few months ago.
Well, there you go.
You've made it.
Aren't you always just like filled with that feeling of when you go in a bookshop, if you see a book there, you're like, why haven't they sold it? And if it's not there, you're like, why haven't they stopped it?
Actually, so every time I find it, I add invisible ink messages to my books. So I'm just like, and then I just pull out all the fountain pens and I'm there for like 30 minutes. And then so I don't feel bad when it's not sold, although that now I probably will feel bad. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks for
playing. No, so you got to think of it the other way around, Ed, because I'll go into a store and I won't see it there. And then my initial reaction is to get sad, like, oh, they're not stocking it. And then I'm like, no, they're sold out.
They just sold it.
Am I tricking myself?
They
most
can't
likely
keep it on the shelf. But
why don't they have enough copies? Why haven't they ordered enough?
I should have a whole end cap. Come on, guys. Yeah.
Brandon Sanderson has two whole bookshelves in the Barnes & Noble in Orem. It's kind of intimidating.
I mean,
like the whole...
At my chapters, Sarah J. Maas has like three bookshelves. Yep. And it's like...
And then like two tables.
I feel bad for anyone shelved like on either end of her because you just know... how about you, Ed? Where can we find your stuff? And where can we find you?
You can find me, Ed McDonald Writing edmcdonaldtfk.com, Twitter at edmcdonaldtfk. You can find me on Instagram at edmcdonaldauthor. I've just started back up on Facebook, so if you're in various groups on Facebook, then we might might run into each other there. Yeah, if you stalk me, then I'll notice, depends how good you are. You're a Red Winner, Raven's Mark. You can buy them in bookshops, you can buy them where all the places where they're in the books. But if I may say, for Dora Red Winter, Samara McLaren's audio narration, I wanted a Scottish narrator, and they weren't sure whether America would like a Scottish narrator. So they decided, it's first person narrative. So they decided it would be narrated in sort of received pronunciation English accent, but with the dialogue in a Scottish accent. And they lasted about 25 minutes in the recording studio before they called me and said, it's not working!
Yeah.
So it's beautiful. Beautiful Scottish accent the whole way through.
That's right. That's what we like.
So I recommend the Audible version.
Yeah, that's definitely on my TBR now. I'm a sucker for a Scottish accent.
I love the Scottish accent.
Yeah. How about you, MJ?
Yeah, so you can find me on all the socials. So Twitter, Instagram, TikTok. Blah blah blah. At MJ Kuhn Books. Hi Adrian.
He was lurking.
Also find me supervising at SFF Addicts Pod with my bestie Adrian M. Gibson. We post episodes every Tuesday. So yeah, and then just mjkuhn.com and check out Among Thieves. Check out Thick as Thieves. You can pre-order it. I'm doing a promotional pre-order campaign with a local bookshop that is fantastic in my area, just a little indie store. And you get a freebie. And it's signed if you order it through them. So the links are all in my bios on all my socials. So check it out.
And what's the release date for that one?
Oh, yeah. July 25th. It's coming up.
Ooh, just over a month now. And I guess that leaves me. You can find me mostly being weird and inappropriate on Twitter at Swamatar. I have a website that I updated it in April when I launched my book. It's got maps on it and it's got a character list so that people jumping into Brick and Bone are like, who's that again? I've got it on the website. That's really it. I would say Facebook, but I don't like Facebook. I guess I'm on Instagram too. And that's it for us. Thank you so much, everyone, for coming by. And thanks for chatting with me, you guys. This was really fun.
Yeah, thank you for hosting. This has been so fun.
Thank you for making us feel deeply unhealthy, Ed.
I just have a goal now. I will write with my pen, but also in the south of France. How's that for a compromise?
Yeah, there we go. We're gonna meet in the south of France and kind of lurk around them. And
there you go. I'll meet you there, Crystal.
If we're good at stalking, he might not notice us. So
yeah, that's he's gonna do training. It'll just be our vacation. Okay. Yeah. Thank you for coming.